Well, thank you all for being here. A special guest today, my wife Connie is with me, and my son Jacob is back there getting himself a cup of coffee. So we're going to close out this three-week session today with the story from Luke about the walk to Emmaus. Now, the last 2 weeks, we've been reading passages from John. So I thought I would just start by giving you a quick synopsis of what Luke has had to say about the events of the burial and Easter morning before we pick up, since we know what John has said about the burial and Easter morning. So Luke has just a few different observations about that. So Luke starts in chapter 24, verses 13 to 35. Well, that's the road to Emmaus. In 23, 50-56, he talks about the burial. We have Joseph of Arimathea asking for the body. Joseph actually himself takes the body down, wraps it in linen cloth, and places it in a rock-hewn tomb where no one had ever been laid. Then the women were all with him. They saw the tomb, and they saw how the body was placed in the tomb. So then the story goes on, picks up that they returned home, they prepared the spices and ointments. This would have been late in the day on Good Friday. And then, of course, the next day was Saturday. That was the Sabbath. So they rested. And then the third day, Sunday, the women come to the tomb. And Luke relates that it's Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the other women. So there's a group of women coming to the tomb. Unlike John, where it was just Mary Magdalene, in Luke we have a group of women coming. It's at dawn, they come to the tomb with the spices that they've prepared, and they find the stone has been rolled away. They go in. They go into the tomb. Unlike, remember, Mary, she was kind of freaked out by it. She didn't want to go in. Here they go in, and they don't find the body. And we're told that they're perplexed. And then, suddenly, there's an angel, an appearance of two angels, men in dazzling clothes, standing beside them. This is a little bit more intimate of an appearance here than perhaps in some of the other stories. And Luke tells us that the women were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground. So here, sort of, I think, a more direct, a more visceral sort of reaction to the angels. In some of the other accounts, things that we've talked about, angels have appeared and people haven't been quite so taken aback by it, or they haven't seemed to quite understand the significance of it in the same way. But here, it appears the women really understand these are angels. They bow their faces to the ground. And the angels ask, "Why do you look to the living among the dead? He is risen. Remember what he told you." And the women remembered his words. So they return from the tomb and they tell the 11 and all the rest. So again, there's a lot more people involved here in Luke's account. The apostles, the word seemed an idle tale, and they did not believe. But Peter runs to the tomb, looks inside, and sees that the linen cloths are rolled up, and we're told that he goes home amazed. Okay. So that's what's transpired in Luke before we pick up with the passage we want to talk about today. So now we're going to pick up with this story about the walk to Emmaus. This is taking place later in the day, on what would be Easter Sunday. Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name is Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him. Then he said to them, 'Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?' Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, 'Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, 'Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?' That same hour, they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, 'The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon.' Then they told what had happened on the road and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread." That's just an amazing story. I think one of the most beautiful in all of the Gospels. And it is it's just, there's so much there to talk about. Some of the commentaries that I was reviewing as I was getting ready for this pointed out that the temptation is to try to, if you're going to speak about this passage, the temptation is to try to speak to all the points that it makes, but this makes for too many. It's a passage that invites you to come back again and again and again. And as one person said, the Emmaus story is a rich mine to which one should return again and again, bringing out one cockload of ore at a time. So it is, it's a wonderful story, and I would encourage you to just sort of mark it and read it again and again as time goes on. It's beautifully written. And it really sets up for us, I think, it kind of meets us where we are in some respects. Here are these two disciples walking along this road to Emmaus. Now, we don't really know where Emmaus was. If you remember Leslie's sermon last week, she said we weren't not really sure where it was. It wasn't a particularly notable location. It's not famous for anything. And you have to wonder, well, why were these two disciples, why were these two followers of Jesus walking to this place? I can only guess that they were probably going there to get away. They wanted to get away. Things had really gone south in Jerusalem with Jesus and his followers. They were, as we've been talking about, trying to imagine the despondency and despair that must have gripped them after the events of Good Friday. And now there's this talk about the tomb being empty and angels appearing to women. And I can just imagine they must have just said, let's take a walk. Let's get out of town for a few days and sort of settle down. And it's really, I think it poses to us that question. It forces us to recognize that question that we have to admit, if we're really, really truthful, we all have. And that is, did this really happen? Is there really any basis to believe? Is there any persuasive reason to believe that Jesus was really raised from the dead? Or that God is truly present in the turbulence of our lives? We have to admit, the question plagues all of us from time to time, no matter the strength of our faith. And I think this story acknowledges that question and embraces it. So, they're going to this place, so what, I think it sort of, the story begs us to consider, what is our Emmaus? Where do we go to get away from it all? Well, maybe, maybe we go out shopping and indulge in, retail recreation, thank you. Maybe we decide to go on a vacation. Maybe we, if you're a guy and you have a midlife crisis, you buy a sports car. Whatever. We all have something, someplace, something we retreat into. Maybe it's a TV show. Maybe it's a video game. Maybe it's a video game, Jacob. So there's something. We all retreat into something because life is too much. At times. It's all too much for us. This is quoting from, I hope I pronounced this right, Friedrich Buechner. Friedrich Buechner. And he talks about Emmaus as the place we go to in order to escape. Emmaus is whatever we do or wherever we go to make ourselves forget that the world holds nothing sacred, that even the wisest and bravest and loveliest decay and die, that even the noblest ideas that men have had, ideas about love and freedom and justice, have always in time been twisted out of shape by selfish men to selfish men. It has been a soul-crushing few weeks, if you watch the news. I will readily admit, I have for the first time in a long time actually wept this week as I have watched the news. There have been a couple of stories that simply put me over the edge. I think the one that was most gut-wrenching was one on Friday night about some starving children, a place where there's some famine has set in, and some aid, a few aid workers have made it in. And there were these utterly emaciated 2 and 3 year old children who didn't even have the strength to speak. And the doctor was holding the shriveled little hand in his. I couldn't take it. I simply couldn't take it. I just broke down and wept. I said to Connie, I can't watch it anymore. And it's just been like one story like that after another this week. And it's just that sense of just being overwhelmed by it. But the story about Emmaus is, okay, you know, it says that maybe you're overwhelmed, maybe you're trying to get away from it all. But even if you do that, even if you're trying to get away from it all, God is going to come after you. God is going to be there. You may encounter God, and you'll certainly encounter God when you least expect. And, you know, you're on your way they're on their way to Emmaus, and Jesus joins them. And they don't know it's Jesus. The words say that their eyes were kept from seeing. This is one that if the clergy want to comment on what the Greek was that was behind that. I'm not sure if that's a particularly accurate translation. I can't read Greek, so I don't know, but that's one where I'd really like to dig in and see what the translation meant. But anyway, their eyes were kept from seeing. Now, whether that was just their own inability to recognize, or if Jesus had a greater purpose in trying to keep himself hidden from them for a little bit. But they don't know it's him. But they strike up a conversation. And even though Jesus is able to, you know, really help them understand the scriptures, he's able to say, well, gee, you know, these things you're talking to me about, these things that happened to this Jesus, wasn't this all what has been prophesied in the scriptures? And walks them through it all, and their minds are open. So they're intrigued by this person, this stranger that they've met, even though they don't know him to be Jesus yet. So when they get to where they're going, it's evening, and they beg him to stay, to come in and have a meal and stay the night with them. And Jesus does. And then in the breaking of the bread, their eyes are open. They realize who it is. And in that instant, he vanishes. So that to me was one of the really, really interesting points in this story. The instant they knew who it was, he vanishes. And to me, and some of the commentators that I was reading, they point out how our own experience of God is fleeting. We have those times when we do have a very profound sense of God's presence in our life, an immediate and profound sense of God's presence. We can all probably remember at least one or two occasions when we could say, in that particular place and time, at that moment, I really felt the presence of God. And it may have been, you know, the loved one's deathbed, it may have been the birth child, whatever, but we all can remember, I think, those times. And one of the ministers at a church that I used to go to preached about this idea often. She would talk about it being sort of like a membrane between our space and time and the space and time and the place the other side of God is. And I don't think that God's here too, but the nearer presence of God. It's like a membrane. And in some places, just a little bit, the membrane gets really, really thin. Really, really thin. And you can sense more strongly that God is there. And this story, I think, really drives that point home. And encourages us to learn to treasure those experiences and to be able to treasure them in the moment that they're happening, but also to treasure them in retrospect, to be able to look back on them and reflect on them and grow in faith as a result of that. These disciples, they're doing that, that they say to one another, did not our hearts burn within us? They recognize, there's a strong tradition in the Old Testament. The commentaries went on for pages with all the different citations back to it. But there's a strong tradition in the Old Testament of this idea of entertaining angels in disguise. You know, you might be entertaining people and they're actually angels, but you don't know when you're having this interaction with them. And so there's sort of an element of that in this. We talk about in so many places here, that in the earlier part, the earlier part before the road to Emmaus, what the angel said to the woman in the tomb was, remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee. And then the women remembered. So it's remembered. These disciples, the people around Jesus, had heard all these words. And had heard Jesus spoke about this, we're told in the Gospels, at great length, and many times he told people what was going to happen, what would have to happen, how he would have to suffer and die and then be glorified. But they sort of weren't getting it. And then they're asked to remember, and they remember. So I think it's asking us to remember. You remember those places and those times in our life when we really felt the close presence of God. Let's stop there for a minute. We have a nice group of people here today, a bigger group. So trying to do these three sessions with some interaction, some discussion. So we've got time, and I'd like to just pause here with the few thoughts I've thrown out and see other experiences people might want to offer or other observations. Yeah, thank you.
Just one thing that kind of circled around in my mind as you were talking about the fact that they didn't recognize Jesus, and also the fact that they went out, and there were two people, there were two of them that went out, so they had the buddy, and they're having a conversation among themselves. And going on retreat with someone else is something that actually changed the whole dynamic, and just rather than going alone. And their conversation, they made it so engaged in the conversation of just oblivious to this third person that kind of joined them. They were so focused on their own conversation, I just didn't see it. But the whole idea of going on retreat with a buddy is an interesting concept there.
Thank you for that. I didn't think about sort of what they were doing in the context of going on retreat, but I think that's an interesting way to look at it. They were definitely retreating. They wanted to get away from what they were in that they were certainly looking for space to try to reflect and react.
So it's not an individual thing.
No, it's definitely the importance of right. It's never a one-on-one, it's never a one-alone thing.
In John, was there not a passage that said that Jesus told Mary, I'll meet them in another place?
Yes.
Maybe they were on the way to that other place?
Yes.
Just stopping overnight in Emmaus?
That's possible. I believe that he was going to meet them in Jerusalem. That's what the passage in John said.
That was nice. It was a nice try to get them. So they had their backs to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
No, that was, but it was nice to try to give them some credit. But I think they were truly trying.
Yeah.
On Jerusalem. They might have been going somewhere else. Who knows?
Yeah, and that's actually one of the other commentators talked about that very fact, that they were sort of walking in the wrong direction. Action was really in Jerusalem, but they were walking in the other direction. But you're absolutely right, that they had been given knowledge in that passage in John about, tell my brothers I will go before them and meet them somewhere else.
Also, is there not a passage about in Simon Peter's revelation, he was blinded for a few days.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's one of the other.
So here's another occasion where someone didn't see mm-hmm. what was happening around
them. Yeah. Oh, I think it's
maybe just a, I wouldn't call it a folk tale, but a way of telling the uneducated that they just didn't realize what was going on.
A lot of
maybe they weren't really blind, maybe they just didn't realize.
Yeah, there's a lot of sight being restored in different ways. It's a common theme. Anyone else? Yeah.
Is there any parallelism studied between this passage and the passage where Peter is leaving Rome and meets Jesus on the road and is asked where he's going and turns back?
You
go a long way back in the commentary. I can't put that in my head. But what gets me every time I hear those stories is they take you to a point and they just drop. He disappeared? Wait a minute, can we stop and visit that for a while? Is there a parallel with Peter? They do that all the time.
And I think, to me, that sort of struck me as God sort of gives us enough to get us back, but then if we remember from what he said last week in the context of Doubt and Thomas, blessed are those who believe that they have not seen. So what God really wants is he wants belief without having to see, without having to have that profound experience. So he there's sort of a theme, I think, in these post-resurrection experiences that to me, again, I'm not a theologian by training, but it just strikes me that there's a strong element of just giving enough to get people, just giving them enough. Just the appearances of the tomb are fairly brief, but they're very poignant. The appearances with the groups. He does not spend long periods of time of wandering around with people, the post-resurrection. He's a very pointed, short, very profound experiences.
I look at this story and I see the parallel to one of his parables when he talks about the lost sheep and the shepherd who would leave the 99 to go out for the one and bring it back. And in this sense, the two parts that are poignant for me is one, that when the two sheep are leaving, he goes out of his way to meet them and find them. But two is once he's done and he is vanished, what do? Do they continue on their way having experienced him? No. They turn around and they go back. Mm-hmm. And so he did what he was sent out to do, or what he intended to do, which is save the lost sheep and bring them back to the fold. And so it's a good example. He said how he was going to treat his disciples in the parables, and then we see an example of him doing precisely that, coming and meeting us where we are in our own weakened state of leaving to capture us and to re-engage our attention back to where we need to be.
Good. That's a great point, Roger. That's actually the next thing I want to talk about is that having had this experience, that they trudged this, we're told, 7 miles. They had traveled the 7 miles to Emmaus. They have this experience. And They jump up and hasten to go back to Jerusalem. They're bursting. They have to tell the others. He is risen. We have seen him. So, I mean, you can imagine how tired you would have been walking 7 miles and all that they had been through and the state of mind they must have been in. But what a life-altering experience this was for them. So much so that they jump up and immediately go back. They have to share. And that's such an important aspect of the story, that these, in keeping with the comment about the being sort of the two people together, the experiencing the presence of God is never to be a private gift. It's not, we may be with others when we have these profound experiences, or we may be by ourselves when we have them. But God's intention in our having these experiences, in having us share that, proclaim that, part of our mission to proclaim the gospel to the extent that we actually live it, we experience it, we're filled with joy, we have to share it with other people. And I think that's an important aspect of this, that that they rush back to share their experience joyfully. He is risen. He is alive. The Lord has risen indeed. It's like they're finally getting it. I mean, one can only imagine perhaps the women rolling their eyes at this point. Well, finally, they believe. We told you. Some see these kinds of experiences and people sharing these kinds of experiences as an idle tale. They're hallucinating or they're whatever. But for those who have witnessed God's transcendent presence in their lives, whatever Emmaus they may have been at, whether it's a tomb or a lonely road or a broken relationship or whatever disappointment or failure you may have had, if you have witnessed God's transcendent presence in your life, that is a transforming reality. Once you have experienced that, life is never the same. Once you open yourself up and you experience it, your life can never be the same again. And I feel badly for people who, I'm very good friends with some people who I know are professed atheists. And I'm struck by how hard they work at being atheists. it truly is. It is its own belief system, and they work really hard at it. And I feel badly for them because they have shut themselves off from the possibility of experiencing God's grace in their life. And God can certainly break through, He may find a way, but it strikes me that it's so much harder. If we as people of faith can be more open to recognizing these events when they happen. And they happen in the most mundane and least expected places. That's what I think really strikes me in all of this, and struck me in a lot of the commentary that I read, was you tend to think you're going to have this experience, maybe in church, or with official church, or street. Somehow there's a special place you're going to be where you'll have this transformative experience. And that is frequently not the case. A lot of the miracle stories are just sort of things happen out in the middle of nowhere. People weren't expecting something to be miraculous. Certainly these two of travelers, when they invited Jesus in to spend the evening and to have a meal with them, they were not expecting and anticipating this miraculous event that was going to take place. They were intrigued by this guy, and he was, you know, very knowledgeable about the scriptures, and they enjoyed talking to him, but they had no idea that that was Jesus, and they were just completely, sort of, they're struck by their unpreparedness when this happens. And so, likewise, I think we're called to look for that in places, and I know I have seen it in places. I've seen it in the kindness of people who were around when my parents were late in life and their health was failing. People who were in the nursing home, people who, the strangers who would help. And you can find it in so many places if you're open to seeing it, if you're open to sort of thinking about the presence of God and the Holy Spirit being at work in the world. But when you have that, when you have those experiences, they do become a transforming reality. And then the last major point on this is that Easter is not over at sundown. That's not the end of the story. Easter stretches out across our entire life. The women, you know, they could not call those angels back. The disciples might never again see Jesus. But it doesn't matter, because life will never be the same because they've had that experience. The Easter reality is the Lord is risen and he comes back to meet us on our road to Emmaus. That's the kernel of it. That's what I found so uplifting in this story. And through our study of scripture and in the breaking of the bread, we are going to come to know him. And that's such a powerful insight, and I thought it was interesting the term that the two travelers used about their hearts being strangely warm as he opened the scriptures to them. So that's sort of all the formal stuff that I had. Let's open it up. Tried to cover a lot of territory, probably a lot more than I should have in that, but I didn't feel constrained as though I were giving a sermon, so I felt I could.
Just kind of an amusing anecdote, you mentioned your friends who are atheists and how hard they work at that. There was a commentator on NPR 6 months ago or so who was interviewing an atheist who is now a speaker and has written a new book. And this particular fellow was saying that atheists are suffering because they are self-isolated, because they don't have an organization to be part of. So he was arguing for atheists to organize together and commune together. And the commentator was like, but that's a lot of work, because you could just join a church, you know, because he was saying, there's a communion already built for you. And he's like, no, I'm not arguing for religion, but we need to be together. And so it was just, the commentator was really pushing him on this issue, sort of like, why don't you open up? So I thought your comment was really interesting, how hard people work sometimes, whereas if they could just relax and open up, what they might experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, isn't part of one of the communion prayers be known to us in the breaking of the bread? And we've said that every Sunday.
Yeah, that's what struck me about that.
Well, I just thought that their eyes weren't open. I think God has to do a lot of work on any of us. in the Acts, all of, you know, Luke's second part two is the Acts of the Apostle, and often when baptized. And so, like, he's doing work ahead of us all the time. And I feel like that it's probably, we work pretty hard, too, whether we're believers or, I feel like all of us are sort of stubborn and not seeing.
The thing that grabbed me about the story is that, you know, the Jesus-led Bible story along the way, in which there, he opens up all the passages and Hebrew scriptures and pointing out that he's predicted the Messiah, because Jesus doesn't do it. It's the sacramental experience of the breaking of the bread that does it. And that's something that is, you know, you experience over and over again. So to me, the faith journey is not this one magnificent experience that I personally had in the past that's the foundation for my faith, but rather that continuing process of being in communion and having that sacramental experience in a community that represents faith, and that is the transformation experience, not, you know, one particular personal experience in my life.
That's a very good observation, and it is this passage for me really sort of drove home the significance of what we do every week in the Eucharist, and that the presence of Jesus. You know, we're reminded of that every week, and I think this reading this again and thinking about it again, it opens me to perhaps being more thoughtful and more, you know, sort of less mechanical about the process of receiving the Eucharist and a little bit more reflective about what that means. And you're right, that's the way belief, it's the way the faith is. This transmitted. Yes. No, yeah, I have to grab your hand up. No.
Who's the famous pollster? I can't remember his name.
Gallup?
Yes, George Gallup. He's an Episcopalian.
Oh,
and he had his own very powerful personal spiritual experience, which showed him to wonder, does anybody else experience that? So he created a poll, and he found that most people have what they would call a spiritual experience, a transformative experience, but people don't like to share that because everybody else thinks you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's borne out in my experience. If I ask, people will tell me with some hesitancy about that, but Jesus doesn't stick around in those. Make appearances, give you what you need, and it goes on its way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important. He's not done. He's got a lot of people to talk to.
Thank you for raising that, because I think it's very true, and I think, you know, I think we sometimes tend to want to think, well, we're going to have one of these experiences, it's going to be that the earth will quake and the thunder will clap. Well, maybe it isn't going to be that. I mean, certainly for me, I think perhaps there was a single dream that I had when my parents were both passed. There was a dream that I had of seeing my mother on the phone, and she was absolutely glowing, almost like angelic. And she was on the phone, and she said to me, "I just talked to your father. Everything is going to be all right." And that was a transformative experience for me. If ever I felt a point where God literally reached out and touched me directly, it was in that experience. And I shared it with my minister at the time, and he said, you know, do not discount it. You know, dreams play a very important role in scripture, and they're profoundly related to what's going on in our conscious and subconscious. So we live in a time that's quick to dismiss things like that. But if you sort of step back and open yourself, you know, maybe that was God somehow trying to give me some reassurance that, you know, we're on the right path. It's going to be okay. Yes.
Back to your comment about the Old Testament revelations about angels and so forth. The people at the time reading those things about angels and so forth, and then we heard that Jesus told Mary, "Don't touch me." And then he appeared in the upper room when the doors were locked. So he could have been an apparition, because he comes from God. And God could have made him come into being a six-legged talking giraffe, whatever he wanted. But the people, you know, if they'd seen a six-legged talking giraffe on the road to Emmaus, they would have probably been a little bit surprised. But he comes to us in faith in the different ways, and we see him in such as your story, seeing your mother and seeing things in nature, and just seeing people who do good things for other people, are sort of like apparitions, but they are Christ-like.
Yeah, and I was always struck by, I've always been fascinated by the resurrection, and my former minister at my church told me at one point, if you really want to understand the resurrection, read Corinthians, Paul's account of the resurrection. And it was actually the passage that I chose to read at my father's funeral. And it talks about the that which decays will be made whole, and God will give to each the body that he decides. You know, so it's, you know, yeah, he's back, but he's in a different form. He's risen. He isn't the same thing that went into the tomb.
But we've become so used to the scientific method that you mentioned last week, I believe, in that we have to have facts and proof and touch. But Thomas didn't get that until later on when he said, "Do touch me," which meant he was probably physical at that time.
Mm-hmm. And again, the thing that I think really struck me last week, if you remember, Thomas didn't actually have to follow through and touch. It was just the grace of Jesus offering Thomas the opportunity to do that was enough for Thomas. So it's sort of another one of these things where God comes to gives you just enough to get you over the line. Anything else? This one we could probably spend the day on.
I was just thinking that we don't spend enough time in letting that moment in part stay with us. And we have this right here, but we're going to go out to the narthex and everybody's going to be talking. And so we're taken out of the time of stopping to read and listen. And even when we go into the church where we're supposed to be quiet and prayerfully enter into this time, we're still going to have talking. And so we don't allow ourselves to have enough moments of just experiencing and holding on to that.
That's very well said, and that's really one of the main takeaways from this, is that notion of holding on to the experience that you've had, holding on to the tradition. If you spend the long tradition that you've had of going and being part of it, but taking the time to reflect on what has that meant, how has that helped you, how has that changed your life?
Absorption comes from our mind.
Yeah, that's a great word. That's a great word, I think. I can think of times in my life when going to church was somewhat more mechanical, perhaps, than other times. And if you just allow yourself to slow down and just kind of let it seep in, and let yourself absorb it, it becomes a much richer experience, because it's easy to, you know, go in there and look at the watch and all that, I gotta do this, I gotta do that, but clean the house, I gotta mow the grass. But if you just let yourself go from all of that for a minute. Well, we're way over, I'm sorry. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Good job. Thank you for the last presentation.
Thank you.